Welcome to Mid-Century Modernism with Monique, your go-to podcast for all things architecture, design, and innovation within mid-century modernism. Join me on a journey through the golden age of design, where every episode brings you fresh inspiration for modern living and unlocks the secrets of this iconic and timeless style. What are we waiting for? Let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Mid-Century Modernism with Monique. I'm Monique Anton, your host, and I am here with a man who needs absolutely no introduction, Mr. Stanley Sadowitz. Stanley, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you on the show, and I'm obviously a big fan, and you were so nice to come to my home for my housewarming party where I am doing this podcast, and we have a lot of people that are excited to hear from you, so we'll just jump right in if that's okay.
Right.
Okay. So you've had such an amazing life growing up in South Africa and starting your work in Johannesburg. And I wanted to ask you what your experience was like. You had a mentor from Mozambique and you learned about modernist architecture. But what was it that really got you started in this work?
You know, I grew up in a suburb that was under construction. We were one of the early houses in the suburb. It was called Emerentia, and it was, you know, just outside Johannesburg. And so while I was growing up, there was always a lot of construction going on our street and down the road and around the corner. And as a kid, I used to watch these buildings getting built. And from that, I think I started being interested in this process of making things appear out of nothing. You know, there would be an empty lot and then these people would come and lay bricks and suddenly, you know, there was space inside and then they put on a roof. And it was kind of a magical sort of activity that I used to be fascinated by. And I didn't really know what an architect was until I was probably about 8 or 9. And I went on a school trip, and one of the girls' fathers who chaperoned us on this trip was a man by the name of Felix Fels, and he was an architect. And so that was my first kind of consciousness of this as a sort of way to be employed, or, you know, like a kind of a job. And so, you know, afterwards, I befriended his daughter, Pam, and I would go to their house. And they lived in a kind of contemporary house with big sliding glass doors. And, you know, it was quite different from our house, which was more conventional with rooms and you know, inside and outside. Their house blended with the outside, and it was, you know, like very open and light. And that was the first kind of time that I actually experienced what architecture could be. And so, you know, that was sort of when I was quite young, and I never had any kind of question about what I was going to do after that. I remember my, you know, my older brother had to go for counseling to help find out what he was going to do. He ended up being a dentist. But for me, there was never any kind of question. I just knew that that was what I would do.
Wow. And in an interview that you gave previously, I remember you were talking about how it was kind of a spiritual thing for you. How you felt that nature and architecture were one, they blended. It was a part of your expression, and it was also a part of you just seeing things around you. And I wanted to talk with you about that as well.
You know, growing up in Africa, there were, you know, Johannesburg was actually a modern and quite beautiful city. Unfortunately, a lot of that beauty has been eroded now. Mm-hmm. But when I grew up, you know, there was really like powerful modern architecture, and there was an area called Hillbrow, which was one of the densest sort of urban pockets in Africa and probably in the world even. And it was all these beautiful high rises. And so, you know, I grew up with that on the one hand, and then the natural world on the other, which was just, you know, like a few miles away was the Transvaal, which was this big plateau with these grasslands, and you know, there were animals that you could see in the wild and things like that. So, you know, there was a very broad kind of cultural bracket that we lived in. And so I had, you know, a measure of both of those things, like the ancient and you know, the modern. And it was all kind of wrapped up together.
Mm, beautiful. And your trip to Europe, you had mentioned that you went to Europe and had an amazing time in Barcelona, and you saw different architecture that influenced you. When you went off to Berkeley and you saw the California architecture, did that shift your work at all, or how was that mixed together?
You know, quite honestly, when I came to Berkeley, I'd already, in a way, established a kind of work ethic, and I knew, you know, my interests and so on. And, you know, at that time, it was mostly buildings in the landscape. I was working on private houses in the landscape. So, you know, the first work that I did in California was sort of just transposing that set of experiences of the Transvaal to California. And the landscape of California I found, you know, incredibly inspiring and beautiful. I wasn't impressed with the architecture, especially in Northern California. And, you know, I had grown up with a much more rigorous kind of exposure to modernity. And, of course, Los Angeles was different, and I visited there a lot and you know, had wonderful experiences with the case study houses and the sort of evolution of modernity. I mean, I think really modern architecture in California started with the Schindler House on King's Road as the first modern building, because I don't really consider Frank Lloyd Wright a modern architect. He's just Frank Lloyd Wright. But, but you know, so I loved that work. And but Northern California, you know, most of the sort of mid-century modern and modern architecture was quite hidden in the hills and hard to find. And, you know, even quite recently, during COVID, I started inventorizing the sort of history of modern architecture by photographing. I photographed over 100 modern buildings in San Francisco, mm-hmm. which I are on my website.
You know, sedawitz.com. Yes. Okay.
Yes, and if you go to the research area, you'll see you know, this collection of buildings that I photographed. And so there was actually a quite powerful sort of mid-century modern and even, you know, stretching into the 70s modern architecture, which was mostly focused on commercial architecture, institutional architecture. I mean, the hospitals built some beautiful buildings. So there was, you know, quite a robust school of modern architecture. But, you know, it's blended in with all this sort of Victorian pastiche, and it gets a bit but foggy.
Yes.
So the reason why I decided to try to establish this sort of collection of 100, it wasn't necessarily 100 buildings, but I think it is about 100 buildings, was to just sort of, exhume my roots as a sort of modern California architect, which, the things that happen in Northern California after the sort of case study export from Southern California, and there were some really good architects who built beautiful modern houses, even, your house and houses in the North and South Bay. But, they're few and far between. So that was sort of the purpose of documenting this kind of history. The thing that was sort of most pervasive when I got to Berkeley was, the kind of sea ranch and picturesque sort of pre-postmodern world of architecture. And it was stuff that really had no interest for me. I thought sea ranch was interesting ecologically and all that, but architecturally, I don't care for barns.
I love your honesty. I view your work as larger than life, incredibly bold, escaping reality, really. I've been in your projects in San Francisco. I've been in your projects on the peninsula. And I wanted to highlight a couple of them. Your Oz house in Atherton is just ridiculously amazing. The Leaf guest house in Napa, I was going to talk about that, how similar that home, the structure was to the Labeson residence in Marin. These homes are unbelievably, you come up to them and it's almost like you're looking at a part of nature. They blend into the landscape so well. They almost, you have to search to, find this house. One part of the home, I have this book actually in front of me, your book.
Pitch House. That's yes. My old book. I actually have a new book. Let me just get it.
You have to go, listeners who are watching this on YouTube, you can go to my YouTube channel and see what we're holding up here. This is his other book. Okay, so the 75 works. So do yourself a favor and go on Amazon and grab both of these two when you get a chance. But the house I'm talking about, the Labeson residence, as you can see, it's literally a bridge between two hills and it's unbelievable. So these two homes.
I would just say one thing about my work. That was a very, very practical way to deal with that site. That was a site in San Anselmo that for various reasons, no one had ever built on, mostly because it was so steep. And the previous attempts to build on that site were always to kind of bench it into the hill and build a lot of retaining walls and all that. When I went to the site, I just thought, I'm going to leave the site alone and just build a new kind of ground, which is this bridge. And it made it very simple. There's actually very little earthwork that was required. And, I like to kind of think that the pragmatic is also a poetic, that there's no difference really between the two things. Like often people think they two different kind of planets, but for me they're the same, that one can be very direct and simple, and that can create a kind of poetry and richness.
That's beautiful. So I've also seen in your other interviews, you talk not so much about the residential homes that you've built, but the cityscapes is what you mentioned you're most passionate about. I have been in 1234 Howard in San Francisco, and I have a friend of mine who lives there. The entry, really, because that street is a little, you know, the environment isn't so comfortable, but the entry, as soon as I walked in, I was kind of transported into your world. And I love how you do that with a lot of your projects. The design was so simple, but you've been quoted as saying before, the simpler, the more emotional sometimes. Can you kind of explain that thought with your process of designing these amazing entryways and San Francisco buildings?
The entry there is a real sort of shift from outside to inside. It's dark, and when you walk down, there's a trough of rocks all along the one side. And it really is to provide a transition from the street. When I built the building, the street wasn't as bad as it is now. But, you know, south of Market's become the new Tenderloin. And yes. So, you know, it's definitely a kind of bridge that changes your experience completely. And then once you come into the building itself, it's the complete opposite. It's just full of light. So, you know, it's about this shifting of experience, and it makes the moment you get out of the elevator and walk into the courtyard, which is this other kind of bridge space that the units are arranged around, you know, totally different again. So, you know, it's just about manipulating the conditions to highlight their differences and really emphasize, you know, the experience.
Yeah. One of my favorite projects, moving on to commercial spaces that you've done, is Oxbow, the Oxbow School in Napa. And they have a little video if you research Oxbow in Napa. This school is unbelievable how you've made all of these similar buildings next to each other. And the students have an enhanced experience through that place. Can you share with us what it was like constructing that? It must have been really difficult to do.
The site is incredibly beautiful on this oxbow of the Napa River. And I mean, essentially, as an art school, it's a collection of warehouses. But what was special about these warehouses is that they actually dissolve completely. They have these big garage doors, and they open entirely out into the landscape and onto the river. And it really stems from a experience that I had as a child. When I was going to school in South Africa, there wasn't really art taught at school. And my parents were very tuned to my needs. And so my mother found this art teacher, and the art classes were in a garage in another suburb in Johannesburg, and we mostly worked outside. You know, she kept all the stuff inside, but the desks and where we drew and made things was out in the garden. And so I always had that memory of what an art school experience could be, of working in nature and out of the building. And so that was one of the sort of aspects of the art school.
It's amazing. Yeah, the visuals, just, you have that in the book as well. But the visuals of just opening up and being in nature just really was wonderful to me. You introduced me to an architect that I had never heard about before, Rex Martinson. And I know we've talked about Le Corbusier, we've talked about your love of Mies van der Rohe. And I wanted to talk specifically about Rex Martinson, because I'm sure a lot of other people have not heard about him as well.
So,
how was, yeah.
You know, in Johannesburg in the 30s and 40s, there was a very, very robust modern movement based on the international style, which was, you know, Le Corbusier's sort of foundation. And they, you know, this international style were these kind of pristine white boxes that were floating in the landscape. And, you know, they were beautiful buildings. I mean, like the Bauhaus and all of that were Mies, Le Corbusier, Gropius. And so that style of architecture had a very, very firm basis in Johannesburg. And Rex Martinson was the kind of intellectual leader of that. He was also the head of the school that I eventually went to, but he died in the war. He built a whole lot of these types of buildings around Johannesburg with a firm called Martinson, Fassler and Cook. And there was a house that Rex Martinson built for himself and his wife, not far from where I live. And it was a completely different object from anything that you could see in the neighborhood. Basically, the houses that were typical were, you know, very nice sort of ranch style houses with pitched roofs and a lot of molding and they were made out of brick and that. And his was this sort of almost Grecian like cube that floated on this beautiful plinth of lawn. And, you know, it was perfectly abstract and it was just like a absolutely strange apparition. And I remember seeing it as a child. Actually, I had a friend that lived nearby, and I would always go past the house, take a slight detour on the way to my friend's house so that I could look at this building. Mm. And then, you know, only years later, when I went to architecture school, I found out that it was his house and that he actually had been in communication with Le Corbusier. And if you look in the Le Corbusier Oeuvre Complete, the complete works of Le Corbusier, in volume one, on the first page, there's a letter from Le Corbusier to Rex Martinson saying how amazed he was to discover that there was such a robust modern international style movement happening so far away in distant Africa. And wow. So, you know, there was this very strong connection between the kind of European international style and my sort of teachers, actually, because by the time I went to school, Martinson had died in the war, but there were other famous architects as well, like Norman Hansen. And actually, what's quite interesting is that Denise Scott Brown, who's Robert Venturi's wife, who's also South African, grew up in one of these Norman Hansen houses that was near my uncle's house in a different part of Johannesburg. But I knew the house as well because it was this sort of beautiful abstract cubic object that stood out in, you know, the midst of all this sort of ordinariness of typical like residential development. So anyway, that was, you know, the sort of underpinning of my education were these very, very sort of accomplished modern architects. And then the next generation of my teachers were actually people who went to Penn and studied with Louis Kahn. And so the younger teachers at my school were all influenced by Kahn's thinking and work. Mm-hmm. And so that was how I learned about architecture. And, you know, there was very strong kind of architectural practice going on in Johannesburg. that when I came to Berkeley, I thought, what do architects do now? They don't presence at all. So I had a really, fortunate education, I would say, because there were these really great teachers. And probably the most important figure for me was an architect by the name of Pancho Geddes. And he was practicing in Mozambique. And Pancho had taken another direction. He had been a student of the kind of conventional modern architects, but Pancho, in a way, understood Africa, and he was an African architect, and he built these incredible buildings, just dozens and dozens of them, in Lorenzo Marques. And so I really became very devoted and influenced by his work, because by the time I was starting to practice in Johannesburg, the kind of international style had fallen into disrepute. Mm. And, brutalism was probably the most kind of visible architectural movement. But what was happening was there was suddenly a kind of discovery of like the specificity of place. Like, the international style was the objective of, this universal architecture which could be built anywhere on Earth, and it would always be the same white box. But what started to happen in the later part of the 60s and early 70s, when I was a student, was this shift from this kind of international style to a kind of regional and site-specific sort of way of thinking about buildings. Mm. And so that was what I started to practice. And mm. and it was Pancho who was instrumental in showing that as a possibility.
Mm. I think that might have given you that boost for your teaching. You've given over 200 lectures. You've taught at Harvard, Berkeley. What were the one, if you could maybe pinpoint one or two things that you really wanted your students to understand about this work and the design, what would you say that would be?
I think the most important thing is to understand that architecture is a field of knowledge. It exists. There is such a thing. Often students would think, oh, I just want to do my work. But I mean, that's not, like, architecture is a language, and it's had an incredibly long evolution. It started, I believe architecture started at Saqqara in Egypt. And what I mean by a language is that architecture puts the different pieces of building into dialogue with each other. So a column can have a similar kind of genetic structure to a wall. A window can be like a colonnade. Mm-hmm. There actually is like a synthesis that makes the disparate pieces all speak the same. And mm-hmm. so that knowledge is there, and it needs to be learned. And so, people who think of architecture as sort of this art form that they just make up, I disagree with that. I think it is about this language and about this kind of like knowing of the rules of what create.
Yes, absolutely. I want a quote that reminded me, there's an architect named Stephen Harris out of New York. His firm is called Stephen Harris Architecture. He said, "I think these homes should feel effortless. They should feel as if they've always been there. And the design should feel inevitable." So what you're saying about these works being there and being a real thing, I think that's what makes the work so great, is that you're feeling the space and you're sort of letting it come about as it's there on the site. You mentioned before in another interview that I watched that you grew up in a very spiritual environment, a religious environment, as I did. And I consider myself to be a spiritual person, but you said that architecture and religion can merge. Can you explain that a little bit? How you feel about that? It's a very deep question.
Well, let me backtrack a little bit. So, I did grow up in an Orthodox Jewish family. My father was very observant. The tradition of Jewish thought and, all that whole history was very much how we grew up. And there was always a sense of reverence and devotion and prayer was kind of part of that. And the idea that one of the interesting things about the Hebrew language is that devotion and work are actually the same word, avodah. And so, for me, the act of making architecture, which is this miraculous undertaking where you actually create something that didn't exist. Building a building is bringing something into the world that didn't exist. It's making something out of a lot of effort and all of that, but making something out of nothing. So, there is this sort of magical quality of what we do. And it's the thing that motivates and drives me is just this miracle of having a little thought in your head, which one day, is real and fills a piece of land and is something that you can walk in and feel and so on. So, that's the magic that we do. And it is magical work.
Mm. Do you think that architecture is changing? I know you're still doing these amazing projects, and you just had one that you did in the city, and you've been doing a lot of commercial work. Do you think that is there a way to change the future generation of architects, to influence them this way? And to quote you again on another interview that you gave for Curbed, you said, this architecture is so important and we don't want to spoon feed people designs that are not quality, designs that are not real, and designs that are not pure. What would your advice be?
I think we have a huge amount of opportunity to improve architecture in America. If you look at the building of our city, San Francisco, and what is getting put onto the streets today, I feel that our generation has let the city down. San Francisco is beautiful. What do you say about it? And there's a lot of problems here today, and I don't want to talk about this. But, it is a really beautiful piece of geography, and it deserves, I always thought of architecture as sort of part of the geological evolution of places. I mean, it's buildings are just like geology, but they have holes in them that you live inside and so on. But I just find the work that's being done in the city now not worthy of the beauty of the city. And so, I don't know how to solve the problem. I try my best to give good examples, but nobody copies me, so it doesn't really matter.
Well, they can't copy you. I'm glad that your work is out there so people can see a good example, something that you can feel and something that is pure and beautiful and simple. And I thank you for doing that service to the city. You love San Francisco and you live there. I live there as well.
I really wish we were doing a better job of this generation's contribution. You know, cities are like architecture. They have like long history. I mean, we all build on top of the past and we adding to it. And I think we're doing a lousy job. I think, you know, when you look at the history of this city, there were moments in the city where there were really powerful sort of shared experiences and perspectives about how to build the city. And there were times when that disappeared. You know, there were those like dumb boxes that were built in the late 50s and stucco boxes and things that, you know, are an embarrassment. And I think what we're doing now is in that realm rather than in the realm of the kind of beautiful legacy that we've inherited.
Yes. Well, your firm, you mentioned you have about 14 people at any given time at your firm. And some of these people have been with you for 30 years. And I'm sure you've become a little family by that time. And I'm sure that you're, you know, pumping out this great work in the city. And I'm also wondering about the firms. You maybe have become sort of a professor to them as well in the group.
Well, we've learned together. You know, I have three partners who've been with me for, you know, ranging from 35 to like 30 years, and we've been together learning how to do our work. Yes. You know, I might be the one that points in the direction at the beginning, but we all work together. We're a team. And we are a family, you know. We understand each other. We know each other's strengths and weaknesses. We work very much as a team. And we have, you know, it's not just the people who've been with us for a long time. It's, you know, I mean, this is like 75 buildings that we've done in you know, about 15 years. And so we're incredibly productive and we do an enormous amount of work together. So, you know, it's fun, but it's hard. It's very hard. But building buildings is such an amazing experience that, you know, it's worth the work.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for your contribution to this work and for being such a leader in our community. And for those of you watching on YouTube and listening, you can go to mcmwithmonique.com and also check out Stanley's work and contact him through sadawitz.com. Stanley, I cannot thank you enough for this show, and I will see you soon. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. I hope you had as much fun learning about the world of mid-century modernism as I did. You can also catch the show on my YouTube channel, where we walk through some of the most stylish mid-century modern homes in California. Just search for Mid-Century Modernism with Monique and hit subscribe. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave me a comment to let me know what you think. Your feedback helps me make the show even better. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on Mid-Century Modernism with Monique.